Well, the situation, of course, that Moses is describing here introduces one of the dominant themes of Deuteronomy, and that is that the people have repeatedly not done what God wanted them to do. As we were thinking on Sunday morning, they have repeatedly, despite God's commandments and God's promises and encouragements, they have repeatedly shrunk back from what God wanted them to do. Instead of exercising faith in God, they have been ruled by their fears. And the very opening of the book in the sermon starts with that. Now, there are other major themes as well, but the sermon starts with that one. So, as Moses is speaking here, he's not primarily talking about what God had commanded, although that is enormously significant. He's opening up the point that they had failed him and they'd shrunk back. And he's doing that on the threshold of the river and going into the land now, in order to say, in effect, don't shrink back again. Don't shrink back again. Now, their failure to obey God and to follow the Lord's ways is going to show in all sorts of other ways as well, not simply shrinking back or not shrinking back from entering the land. It's going to show in their obedience or disobedience of God's law. It's going to show in their, principally, in their ability to keep the covenant that they will make with God once they're across the river and into the promised land. Here it is, this sort of shrinking back from crossing over, from going in. And that's what I want us to look at this evening. And they had shrunk back, or this first sort of element of failure, this first element of the first pre-echo, the first signal that these are people who have a problem, is, as he opens the sermon, what was happening at Horeb. So the situation, stuckness at Horeb. And I'm using stuckness not because it's sort of a daft word I've made up, but because it's a word which psychologists and others do talk about as a problem that we have. And we'll come on to stuckness, what it is, as you'll see in a few moments. But let's just first take account of Horeb. The Lord our God, that is Jehovah, our God, said to us at Horeb. What was going on there? Why might they have stayed long enough? Well, Horeb was the place where the law was given, of course. Moses called up the mountain to have direct fellowship with God. Moses, who came back down the mountain with the two tables of the law, two tablets of the law, call them what you will, these two stones with the law engraved on, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, given by God, not invented by men, carried down from the presence of God to men, down from heaven. These Ten Commandments, which reflected not the culture around them, but in actual fact, the very opposite of the culture around them. These Ten Commandments, which reflected not the culture around them, but the character of the God who was over them and with them. Which, you know, immediately, since this was a defining thing for the people of God in the Old Testament, just reminds us again, doesn't it, that the defining thing for the people of God has always come down from heaven, not from around us on earth. The defining thing for the people of God has always been the character of God and not the culture in which we're placed. Take note, Church of Scotland. But anyway. But of course, as the law came down, Moses was bringing it down into a situation where it was already being broken. Because the culture that the people were in had dominated them. And so the very first two commandments are broken before the people have even got them. Their hearts are just nowhere near God. They will not wait. Moses has been up there a long time. Goodness knows what's happened to him. Aaron's getting his head nipped by all these people. And so, of course, the natural thing to do is to get everybody's golden earrings together and melt them down, and gold, whatever else is they had, gold teeth or whatever, melt them all down, turn them into a golden calf. Of course, obvious. And you bow down and worship it. And what this golden calf is presented to them is, this is the God who brought you out of Egypt. God's coming out of Egypt was salvation. Not only salvation from Egypt, but salvation for the promised land and salvation as the Old Testament church. So it not only delivered them from Egypt and propelled them towards the fulfillment of all God's promises to Abraham, it defined them as a people. And this golden calf is suddenly presented as the God who brought you out of Egypt, the God who saved you, the God who's taking you to a wonderful place, the God who defines you as a people. So the law is given and it is simultaneously broken. And of course, that happens as those tablets of stone are broken. And therefore it is a place where all the people have a dramatic encounter with God. Now the dramatic encounter with God started before the Ten Commandments came down and were being broken, because that dramatic encounter with God started with God coming down and saying to the people, don't come near the mountain. Only Moses is to come to the mountain and come up and see me. Nobody else. If you set foot on it, God will break out against them and destroy them because of his holiness. So here is a dramatic encounter that they have as a people. And when a whole bunch of people have a dramatic encounter, it is a kind of a binding thing. It creates a common experience. We've seen that kind of thing in our own day with, for instance, I don't know, I'm going back a long time now, so it seems, but when Diana was killed, suddenly the nation had a common, reasonably common, with exceptions, common experience. So this dramatic encounter with God that the people share is with the God who is holy, and whose holiness is not to be mucked around with. It's not to be played with. It's not a trivial thing. And it's something that breaks out against sin wherever that sin is found, even that, if that sin is found within his people. So it is a dramatic encounter with God who is holy, but of course then God judges, and so many of those people who were involved in bowing down to this golden calf were wiped out. But God is gracious and faithful and gives them the law again after they had both broken it and the tablets were broken. So here you are, here's another copy. Which is by way of God saying, in response to Moses' prayer, Lord, don't destroy them all. By way of God saying, well, okay, here's another chance. Here are the Ten Commandments again. So, holiness, judgment, and gracious faithfulness. Now, those were quite clearly massive experiences for a large group of people to go through together. Would make a huge impact upon them. And for that reason, plus the amount of time they were there, it's no surprise that they got stuck. So what is the stuckness? Let me quote to you from Psychology Today, November 17th, 2009, in an article called Stuckness and How It Is That We Stay There. By a psychologist with the unfortunate name of Michael Formica. I guess he's just a smoothie. It could have been stuck downness and how it is that we stay there. We often get stuck partly because the familiarity of the situations does not necessarily allow us to see the situations as negative, partly because we do not understand how to change them, and partly because we are just too close to see what we need to see. In doing so, we often fail to recognize that we, like fish, are indeed wet. Earlier on in the article, we've been talking about how fish aren't aware of their being wet because it's just totally normal to them. In the same way that, for instance, if you've lived in Scotland for a long time, you cease to hear a Scottish accent. you pick out regional accents, but you don't hear what you once heard when you lived south of the border, because it becomes normal. So we are stuck when we cannot see or don't want to see a way out of a present situation that we are in. John Cowan, writing about stuckness in the work process of computer programmers, software programmers, writes like this: stuckness is the reverse of flow, the state where the programmer simply can't see what's wrong. The point may be, and often is, completely obvious in hindsight, but discovering what that point is literally the same kind of discovery process that scientists use, or mechanics for that matter. You make a hypothesis, you test it, you attempt to fix, see if it solves a problem, test to make sure a new bug hasn't been introduced. There is also a variety of stuckness that arises during design rather than debugging, a kind of analysis paralysis where it is clear that the current way of doing things is wrong, but no clear vision of the correct way has yet emerged. Stuckness is that point that you reach where you just do not know what to do. You perhaps instinctively feel it's a problem, but not necessarily. You can't see a way ahead. You can't see a way out of a situation. You're just stuck. And you have that sort of awful feeling that you don't know, you really don't know what to do. None of the things that you can think of are going to solve a problem that you've got. There's a very interesting piece of research being done and published in the States on youth workers, entitled Youth Workers, Stuckness and the Myth of Supercompetence. And it's not just youth workers. Youth workers and other helping professionals regularly find themselves in situations, it says, where despite their experience and education, they simply do not know what to do or how to respond to the circumstances facing them. And this book is based on the research amongst youth workers in the States. The table of contents for it is very interesting. My stomach fell through the floor. That is the moment of not knowing what to do. Like a deer in the headlights, the paralysis of stuckness. Ever felt like that? Chapter 6, Helpless, Hopeless, and Out of Control, Features of Despair. Chapter 7, Center Stage, that is when the spotlight's right on you and everybody's looking. Humiliation, Being Found Out, and the Myth of Supercompetence. Well, the people are stuck. They are not even attempting a way forward. They've been just so thunderstruck by what has happened. And they have clung to their tents and where their tents are pitched and can see no way forward. They are holding on to those very rapidly familiar, they become familiar very rapidly, those very rapidly familiar plots of land where their tents are. And Benjamin's over there, and they're over there, and Fred, and they're over there. And we know where we are, we're safe, and they're still alive, so God didn't zap them. All of a sudden, they've frozen, they're like the deer in the headlights. They are suffering what several authors refer to as the paralysis of stuckness. So there they are. Their very recent past has determined the present, and for all they know, it's going to determine the future. They're at Horeb, they're not in the Promised Land. They're not moving. They're going to become the Horebites or something if they stay there much longer. They'll start putting down roots. Now, of course, that is a problem, that holding on for dear life to the familiar because you don't know what to do, that is a problem that a whole fellowship's going to encounter. And we'll come to it in a few moments, but perhaps we've experienced it personally in different situations, but fellowships can get stuck with the familiar. They all joke about the patron saint of the Church of Scotland being St. Ibin. It's not just the Church of Scotland, most denominations suffer from this. It's Ibin this way, it's Ibin that way, so it always will be. Why do you do it that way? Well, that's the way we've always done it. Could you try this? Oh, we've never done that before. Or worse, we tried that 30 years ago and it didn't work. So we're scared of doing it again. So, as Tozer puts it, Tozer wrote a very challenging book called The Rote, the Rut, and Revival. And the title of that book, which is really a collection of sermons, comes from something that he wrote in another book where he talked about the routine becoming a rut and the rut leads to rot. And that had so quickly happened to the children of Israel. They weren't going to move. What causes it? Well, certainly some people are more prone to it than others. I mean, within this room, there will be some of us who, simply by temperament, are more prone to getting stuck rather than moving forward. Some of us are, by temperament, quick settlers. We will put down roots very quickly. We are change averse. We don't like it. We get ourselves comfortable and we like to keep it that way. We like to keep the surroundings familiar. We like to keep the routines routine. We feel secure in that and very quickly develop a very well-defined comfort zone. Some of us, by temperament, are just like that. But of course, sometimes our temperament is the very thing that God wants us to overcome. It happens in fellowships particularly when those in leadership positions, in our own situation, the elders, including the teaching elder, the minister, the ruling elders and deacons, or elders and congregational board, or whatever happens in different situations, if there is a tendency, a dominant tendency among the sort of the temperaments within there, to go for the familiar and keep things familiar, then that congregation will tend to be stuck and not move forward and not change, not develop, not grow, not try new things. It will have a very tightly defined set of things which are acceptable here. Of course, that can also be people who are acceptable here. There's a faith issue as well. You see, for some of us, faith is defined by that which is in the past, which we have picked up. Now, that is part of faith. Faith stands in the line of a tradition, of that which is handed down from the fathers. And so we stand in a line that is the faith once delivered to us. But usually in the scriptures that is referred to as the faith. And certainly in church speak and in theology, that's usually referred to as the faith. That is the content of what we believe. And the content of what we believe is something, and some of that is practice as well as doctrine, is handed down to us. But in the scriptures, not the faith, but faith itself, that thing which we exercise, is primarily forward-looking and not backward-looking. Turn with me, if you will, to Hebrews chapter 11 for the most fantastic extended description of everything that the Israelites did not have at Horeb. So Hebrews chapter 11, if you've got one of our church Bibles with you, then page 1209. Now faith, Hebrews 11:1, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now, we run through all these people, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham. What is the thing that characterizes their faith? It is that they are looking ahead. So they might even die not having received what they were looking for. But they are looking ahead. So, for instance, verse 8, where it picks up the story of Abraham. Verse 10, For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Verse 13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. All the way through the hall of fame of people of faith, it is looking ahead, not looking back. You receive what is from the past, God's promises. But the direction you're heading in, on the basis of those, is forwards. And what the people had no sign of whatsoever at Horeb was that faith. They weren't even thinking about what they had received, the promises. They were just stuck. And then, of course, there's a question of obedience. Because God had not called them to go to Horeb and stay there. God had called them to the promised land. There's a question of who are we obeying? Who's the Lord in this? Is St. Ibin the Lord? Are our patterns of doing things exalted to the position of a Lord for us? Now, that's a very real question for congregations to face and for leadership in congregations to face. You remember how Jesus had to speak so clearly to the disciples, saying, "You prefer the traditions of men to the word of God." Well, of course, traditions can form very, very quickly. They got stuck very quickly. In many congregations, something that you've done 3 or 4 times can become the way we do it here. Whereas, 3 or 4 years ago, it was a total novelty that had taken 7 years to reach. Very quickly becomes, "Oh, that's what we do. Oh, we've always done that." Aye, sure. Temperament, the faith issue, the obedience issue. Well, what gets us out of it? All the folk who talk about stuckness in psychological terms are, at their best, they're only picking up on what's already written in Deuteronomy chapter 1. So they could have saved themselves an awful lot of money doing the research and just read Deuteronomy, couldn't they? The solution is an external event. That is, God interrupts us. God disturbs us. We can't get ourselves out of our stuckness. We are the problem, not the solution. By definition, we don't see a way out. We don't see a way forward. By definition, we don't want to see a way forward. That's often the case. And so what happens here is that God interrupts. John Cowan, writing about what happens when a programmer gets stuck rather than is working, as it's called, in the flow, when everything's just happening really easily. When you're working in the flow, interruptions are a nightmare. You need about 15 minutes to get into it. So if you're getting interrupted more than once every 15 minutes, you will never get into that sort of flow where your work rate increases, your creativity increases, time vanishes like that. You've maybe had that experience. You just suddenly look up and a whole hour's gone past. And you've had loads of new ideas and you're seeing things really clearly and you're energized by it. Well, it takes about 15 minutes to get into that. So if you're getting interrupted more than once every 15 minutes, you will never get into that. You will constantly be underproductive in what you're doing. However, if you are stuck, then you're in a different situation. And John Cowan writes this: "Stuckness cannot be overcome by will or planning, only by insight and by the arrival of..." And the arrival of insight is not predictable. "Striving for insight can often be what prevents it from being achieved. The motto, 'sleep on it,' reflects the perception that blocking the conscious mind can be just the right thing to allow the unconscious mind to operate, often giving the key to the problem as if from nowhere. Distraction is an equally successful approach. During times of stuckness, therefore, interruptions are actually desirable as they allow the distraction." So that is the gift, isn't it? Interrupt me, please. Now, that's why I say God's interruptions. Just look at the passage. God wakes them up to a fact about themselves that they were not aware of. So God says, the Lord our God said to us at Horeb, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. That was a disturbing word, a word that was going to disturb them. That was an external event coming in. They didn't think that. They had to have that, you know, that news broken to them. Someone else on the outside could see their problem. God could see their problem. They couldn't. So God wakes them up to the fact about themselves. You've been here too long. Second, he calls and commands them, turn is there, break camp and advance. Turn and break camp and advance. So he tells them what they've got to do. And then he gives them this promise of the assurance of success. I have given you this land, already yours. Success ticked before you've even set foot in it. I have, not I will, I have given you this land. And God urges them on, go in and take possession. And then he gives them this extra covenant encouragement as Jehovah, as the Lord, swore to your fathers, or as the Lord swore he would give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants after them. He gives them this extra covenant encouragement that he who has defined himself as their God and them as his people has promised this. If he's God, it's theirs. If it's not theirs, he's not God. He has this covenant promise. And part of that whole covenant relationship with them is bound up with the promise of the land. As God said to Abraham, beginning in Genesis chapter 12, there'll be a land, descendants, and a name. So the solution is an external event. It is God's interruption, or what we call there the kindness of God's disturbing word. And that is what congregations need. We experienced that ourselves in 2004 when we moved out of the building, and for 11 months we were meeting in Harlow on Sunday mornings, Denver on Sunday evenings, and through the rest of the week there. Now, the activities hardly changed at all. We didn't miss a step from one Sunday to the next. But the atmosphere and what it did for the dynamics of the fellowship, even that very first Sunday morning in Harlow, 6 years ago this last Sunday, completely changed the life of the fellowship. Eggshells that we were treading on got blown away in the space of a week. I would have died trying to sweep them away. Ghosts were around the place. Just got chased away. And we came back in December, reshaped, redirected with a new, clear sense of why we were here and of God's mission that we were part of. People got involved in things that they would never have got involved in before because new things needed to be done. People were sitting in places they never would have sat before because they were in the school hall. But were mixing around and volunteering in ways that never happened. Some people came in because it was easier to go and meet in a school. It was whilst we were out that we started with PowerPoints. Remember those of you who were here at the time up on the stage? Rob Price with my old Dell laptop. Me arriving at the last minute, Rob calmly taking over and saying, okay, I'll get it. Sorting it, didn't need to be asked, he just did it. That was a newcomer playing a key role in what we were doing on a Sunday morning. That would never have happened before. You'd have been coming along for about 50 years to have as key a role in what was happening with everybody gathering as Rob suddenly had. He said, because he was helpful and he could do it. Bands started up on the stage. all the services with the preacher down at the front, instead of going as far away as possible from the people when you're going to speak to them, the most important stuff for the sermon. I started there. All sorts of other things. So now we have to ask ourselves the question, have we got stuck again? I mean, should we not just move out every 5 or 6 years just for the sake of it? You see, we saw that. We were more stuck than we realised until we got out of the place. Now, it wasn't wrong for the people to be at Horeb. They were there by God's command. What was wrong was getting stuck there. So, some questions for you. To what extent do you recognise in yourself a tendency to get stuck? Oh, I've had that problem for donkey's years. I can't get out of it. I'm stuck in that one. Oh, we got stuck at question one, Dominic. We never got to question four. Oh, not a problem for you then. Question two, do you think we're getting into the routine rot syndrome as a fellowship? There you are. Do we need to move out again? Number three, list some of the problems and dangers of stuckness. What happens in a fellowship when that does become a problem? What happens? Four, what wake-ups, that's point one, God wakes them up to the fact about himself, what wake-ups, commands, promises and encouragement can we turn to? Can we turn to in the Bible? What can we turn to in the scriptures and what God has been doing amongst us and what we've seen here and elsewhere in order to avoid stuckness or get out of it? Okay, four easy questions. And the silent bell will ring in 25 minutes and will summon us to pray. On you go. You guys might want to join in with someone else at this point. Yeah.